I'd like to call this Hess meeting to order. It is about 3 minutes after 3. And just before we start, I'd like to ask everyone in the audience to shut off their cell phones if they have them. And let the record show that Representative Seaton, Representative Coring, and myself are here. And we are going to have some overviews today. So let's go charge right along into our agenda. We have an overview today of the Division of Behavior Health, and Mr. Bill Hogan is the division director, and he's going to give us the overview. So let's just let I'm going to let Bill go ahead and give his presentation, at least this part of it, and the slides, and then we'll save our questions till after the slides are done. Okay, Bill, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Bill Hogan. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health in the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell you about our division and what we've been trying to do for the last several years. I have prepared a PowerPoint, and calling my presentation On the Road to Recovery, How Alaska is Transforming Behavioral Health Care. I wanted to let you know that we've been working very actively with our federal partners, regional partners, and community partners in fundamentally transforming how we provide both mental health care and substance abuse service in Alaska. For those committee members who don't know, effective July 1, 2003, we formed the new Division of Behavioral Health within the department by integrating the previously separate divisions of mental health, alcohol and drug abuse, as well as the Office of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome and various staff from the divisions of medical assistance or Medicaid and public health. Our division has responsibility for developing, implementing, and managing, I want to highlight the term managing, a welcoming, accessible, continuous, comprehensive, and integrated behavioral health services system based on sound policies, effective practices, and partnerships. This is our mission statement. The structure of the division has been designed to support this new behavioral health services system as we develop it. And we particularly want to develop a service system that does a better job of serving individuals who have both a mental health and a substance abuse disorder or a co-occurring disorder. Our division structure supports an array of services and programs all the way from prevention and early intervention through treatment, rehabilitation, and aftercare. We took seriously the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health that asked each state to focus on resilience and recovery. And you'll see those terms come up throughout my presentation and discussion. We've developed a pretty comprehensive planning and implementation strategy in order to be able to do this. And I have a copy of a one-page overview of how we are structured that I would like to make available for the committee. I will warn you that it's at first blush, this looks a little bit complicated, but if you will bear with me for about 3 minutes, I'll walk you through it. And hopefully what you'll see is that we've gone to great extent to include all of our stakeholders in this process. So if you look at the top of the sheet, we have in the very middle Behavioral Health Integration Steering Committee. It's made up of a representative from the governor's office, from our department, from the alcohol board and the advisory board on alcohol and drug abuse, the Mental Health Board, and the Mental Health Trust. What you see to the top left is what I just discussed, the creation of the new Division of Behavioral Health. And what you see to the top right is the process that we undertook in the fall of 2003, the stakeholders that were involved, and a series of recommendations in the upper right-hand corner that came out of that process. What you see in the middle section is, again, an affirmation of our overarching goal to develop a service system that's welcoming, accessible, integrated, comprehensive, and continuous at all levels, client, clinician, program, and system level. And then we also have two task forces. We have an external task force to help us with this. You see the agencies that are represented on that task force, as well as our own internal senior management task force. And then finally, on the bottom, we have begun to address complete systems change or systems transformation in the following seven categories. The first is essentially focused, well, let me go back and reiterate that the reason we're doing this is really to provide a much better and more thorough system for individuals with a co-occurring disorder. National literature and research tells us that between 50 and 75% of everyone we serve has both problems. Our system up till now has been pretty separate, so the mental health system seldom talks to the substance abuse system and vice versa. And also it really creates a problem when somebody who is depressed ends up going to a substance abuse agency and then gets referred to the mental health agency because they don't have an alcohol problem and vice versa. So what we really want to do here is to create an integrated system. When I talk about system transformation, we're really talking about changing everything. We're going to be looking at statute and creating a behavioral health statute. We currently have separate mental health and alcohol and drug statutes. We're going to be looking at integrated regulations, behavioral health program and clinical standards. We're going to be identifying the population of people that we're supposed to be serving. That may seem like a no-brainer, but this is a big issue, particularly in a publicly funded system. We're going to talk about what our system should look like, in other words, system of care design. We're going to look at how the system is financed. We currently have a system that is financed through a combination of grants and fee-for-service Medicaid. We think there's probably a better way to finance the system, and we're going to be exploring all options. We're looking at ways to improve information, both the information that we get from providers as well as our capability of sharing information to others. With that, we've implemented a web-based management information system that I'll talk to you about in a few minutes. And also, we are focusing much more on outcomes, and I know the committee is certainly concerned about whether or not we're actually helping anyone. Seems like a radical thought, but it's a very important one. I wanted to let you know that we were one of seven states nationally who received a co-occurring disorders state incentive or initiative grant from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. This grant has given us some resources to be able to undertake this project because this is a huge project, as you can imagine. I also want to reaffirm that everything we talk about on a daily basis is about integration, both at the clinical or client level, as well as at the administrative level. And I will say and want to report that I do believe that we have a lot of momentum. There is a lot of support to move in this direction, and it makes sense for the people we serve. I wanted to give you an example of some of the things that we've been working on. We are in the process of working with both the university and the Mental Health Trust to begin to think about what sort of behavioral health workforce we're going to need for this new system. The university has committed to $500,000 in FY06. The trust has committed to the same to help us think about what sort of staff we need at the entry level. As an example, the Rural Human Services Program, all the way through up through a PhD psychology program. We, again, with the help of the Mental Health Trust, the Mental Health Board, and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, are in the process of providing technical assistance to communities and providers to help them move in this direction. We are currently in 6 communities doing this. Those communities are Tok, Kodiak, Unalaska, Palmer Wasilla, Wrangell, and Nenana. We want to move towards a service delivery system that really focuses on what the community needs, what individuals and families need, and we ultimately want to move towards a system that creates some administrative efficiencies. I'm still of the opinion that I think we can do a much better job of promoting things like shared services so that we, frankly, I think in many communities we don't really need 5 executive directors, 5 financial officers, 5 personnel departments, 5 billing clerks, et cetera. I think there are some ways that we can create some administrative efficiencies to reduce cost, and we are clearly moving in that direction. The next thing I want to comment briefly on is this AK AIMS, or Alaska Automated Information Management System. This, as I indicated earlier, is a web-based system. We've had some of our smallest providers in villages who were still sending us information using paper and pencil. Again, with some help from our federal partner, SAMHSA, we were able to begin to implement this system. On the provider end, this allows providers to use the system as an electronic medical record and also as a billing system. I would like to announce, I know, I think this is the first time, I know this is the first time our division has been able to tell you this, but we actually have some outcome data that we would like to share with you, and we were able to gather this data through this new system. I have a copy of what I'm going to refer to, but it's also up here in the PowerPoint. So what we have asked each provider, and the information I'm going to share with you is for calendar year 2004, although most of the information we have gotten since July 1, 2004. This is based on 4,000 unduplicated individuals being served in our system. And we ask each provider to complete what is called a client status review form. This is attached to the 2-page handout that I just gave you. The client status review form looks at a number of different what we call life domains or outcomes. And we focused on 4 particular outcomes in our presentation today. These are directly related to our performance measures that the legislature has asked us to focus on in FY 05 and 06. The first is that 60% of people being served in our system between intake and discharge reported an increase in more productive activities. Now, if you look at the actual client status review form, there's a question. It is number 2 on the client status review and follow-up form. And this question essentially says, is how often do you do activities such as hunting, fishing, berry picking, work, school, sports, church, social or treatment activities, or any other activities? So what we tried to capture here is whether or not, as a result of our treatment system and services, people are being more active and more productive. And we didn't want to, I mean, ideally it would be great if everyone could gain employment or become employed, but we want to recognize, at least with people who are very incapacitated when they come into our system, we wanted to recognize that any sort of productive activity, whether it's volunteering or church work, basic subsistence activities in the bush, is something that we think is important. So this is... I think this is pretty significant, and again, this is based on 4,000 unduplicated client reports. The next I want to talk about is health. And so what we've noticed based on, again, analyzing the data is that there's been nearly a 70% reduction in individuals reporting physical health problems, keeping them from participating in normal daily activities. I think what this is telling us is that as people come into our system, not only do they have mental health and substance abuse problems, but they also have a lot of physical health problems. As they become, as they begin to stabilize, as they become sober, my sense in general is that they are probably, there are less or fewer physical problems, but that they're also plugged into the primary care system so that they're getting some assistance with their physical health problems by virtue of being involved in our system. And again, I think this is a pretty significant indicator in how our system is helping people related to physical health. The second, or the third indicator, again, based on the question, let me refer this to you, this question, number 9. Do you have enough money to support your basic needs like health care, food, housing, clothing, and subsistence activities? So what this is showing is that from intake to discharge, there was a 70% reduction in individuals reporting not having enough money to pay for some or most basic needs. And again, I think what this is telling us is that by virtue of coming into our system, some people who may have been eligible for public assistance or supplemental security income are now getting that. What I hope this is also telling us is that some people actually went back to work and are now earning money and are becoming productive members of society. And then finally, what I want to comment on is our housing indicator. And the number here is not as substantial as in the first three, but there was a 21% reduction in individuals reporting homelessness between intake and discharge. As you can imagine, a number of the people that we do serve in our system are homeless, and what this is telling us is that there was a 21% reduction in individuals who reported homelessness. In other words, they did find their way into either an independent living situation or some other living situation. Just have a couple more, and then I'll stop for questions. I had the opportunity to come before the committee to talk about the Bringing the Kids Home initiative last week. I won't spend really any more time on that other than to indicate we have a number of kids in out-of-state residential psychiatric treatment placements, and we want to not only bring those kids home to Alaska to stay with their own families and be in their own communities, but we also want to keep kids from going out of state. We have an initiative related to evidence-based practices. Essentially, the way I describe this is these are practices that have been proven to be effective based on research. We have, I think, frankly, taken a shotgun approach to the provision of services. What we want to move towards is a more laser-beamed approach, if I can use that metaphor. We know what works. Why don't we pay for what works and make sure that we get those kinds of services out there? Yeah. We acknowledge that there are some practices that are what's called promising or emerging. There's a consensus that they work. We don't really have the research base, so we don't want to necessarily rule them out. And then, frankly, in Alaska, we have what's called a few Alaska values-based practices. The example I would use here are the recovery camps. I think that's a good example of an Alaska value-based practice. It works. There just has not been research shown, or we've not been able to engage in research to show that it works. I want to comment briefly on our substance abuse prevention initiative. These are additional dollars in fiscal year 06. We are essentially focused in four major areas. The first is we want to work with 11 and 12-year-olds in a program called Reach Out Now. It's primarily community and school-based. We will be giving grants, again, if the legislature approves the governor's budget or approves this in the governor's budget. Our intent is to work both with communities and with schools around this initiative. We have a leadership initiative to fight underage drinking. Mrs. Murkowski is a big proponent of this particular initiative, and we'll be working actively, again, if it's funded, to start an underage drinking program throughout the state of Alaska. We have a local options campaign that we want to undertake, essentially working with villages to determine whether or not they wish to go dry or damp or some variation. And then finally, we have a statewide multimedia education campaign that will be part of this initiative as well. The last couple things, I want to comment on our trauma initiative. We have, according to the literature and research, a number of kids and particularly a number of women in our substance abuse system have a history of trauma, whether it's child abuse or sexual abuse, domestic violence. We want to make sure that that problem is addressed as individuals enter our system, particularly in our substance abuse system. And we want to make sure that whatever we do in our system doesn't create additional trauma. So we're focused on what's called restraint and seclusion at Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, and with some of our inpatient units to make sure that they're not using unnecessarily seclusion and restraint. In other words, we don't want to re-traumatize people. I also wanted to mention that we've been actively involved, particularly since 9/11, in disaster response. Many people have now recognized the importance of ensuring that mental health and substance abuse needs are addressed in any sort of disaster, whether that's a man-made or natural disaster. And we continue to be actively involved throughout the state and nationally to make sure that emotional needs are attended to as a result of disasters. And then finally, I want to just highlight our vision of what we're trying to do in the Division of Behavioral Health. So we really view ourselves as partners promoting healthy communities. We can't do it ourselves. I personally don't think our system should be entirely state-funded by any stretch or even federally funded. I think we need to work actively with our faith-based organizations, our voluntary organizations. I think together we can provide a pretty comprehensive service system. And we firmly believe that there is an opportunity for everyone, no matter how incapacitated by serious mental illness or alcoholism and drug abuse, to be self-sufficient and to be able to contribute to society. And we do believe that there is the possibility of a life in the community for everyone. So with that, I will stop and entertain questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bill. And I did want to note for the record that Representatives McGuire, Anderson, Cisna, and Gardner have all joined us. So we have a full committee now. Also, we have Luke Woodworth with us with the LIO portion of our committee, and our secretary is Sue Warner. And my staff person is Kathy Erickson. So I just wanted to mention that. And now, does anyone have any questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Very nice presentation, and I'm personally thrilled. I think the whole committee probably shares this, to see the emphasis on substance abuse and addressing that issue in the state. I have one quick question on your, I think, next to the last slide. You talked about improved disaster response to ensure mental health and substance abuse needs are addressed in response to any man-made or natural disaster. I'm a little bit puzzled. What do we mean that substance abuse needs are addressed?
I think Representative Gardner, through the chair. Sorry. We actually learned a great deal as a result of the Miller's Reach fire in the Mat-Su back in the middle 90s. And what we recognized, that it wasn't enough to help people find shelter if in fact they had lost their house, but people were very traumatized by that event. And we want to make sure that we're available for individuals to talk about their feelings. We don't want to impose ourselves, because some people choose to seek out family, friends, ministers, mm-hmm. etc. But we want to make sure that we're there for people to talk about their feelings. What is being discovered nationally is, over time, there's an increase in alcohol and drug use as a result of individuals experiencing these kinds of disasters. So we want to make sure that we are aware of that, we pay attention to that, and that part of our substance abuse treatment includes a discussion about how people have felt as a result of these kinds of disasters.
Thank you.
That also kind of goes along with the prevention, the whole prevention part of it, that if we can get a handle on it beforehand and kind of head it off the pass.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Representative Cisna.
Thank you very much. And I was happy to see that on the third from the last slide, bring the kids home, that you're talking about having kids in their own families and in their own communities. And there's been something that's been happening over the summer, early part of the summer, that I first started picking up on people in my community saying that there had been several organizations kind of going around looking for places to put in a new, large 100, 200, 150 bed facility that would be for bringing the kids home. And having worked with kids, as we've discussed before, the best place for kids, I believe, is in the home, and a large warehousing of kids is not bringing the kids home, it would seem to me. And do you know anything about this, and do you have any idea what that might be about?
Representative Cisna, through the chair, we talked a little bit about this last week at the Bring the Kids Home hearing. It is our intent to build the full continuum of care. So I would agree with you that we do need more supportive services to help kids stay in their own families, that needs to be an important emphasis. However, there are some kids who do need more intensive, longer-term residential treatment. My particular bias is that even in those larger facilities, we need to make sure that there's a home-like environment. So, for instance, I think it would be important, even if we were talking about 35, 40, 45-bed facilities, that they perhaps be shaped in a way, ideally, where there would be small cottages, there would be like a campus-like setting. There may be a centralized place for recreation and perhaps eating and that sort of thing. But I do have a bias towards even making the largest facilities more home-like.
Actually, I have a question. With the community planning projects that you talked about, and there were several communities involved, can you go into a little more detail of what that means with those projects?
Yeah, what we chose to go into what I would say are diverse communities. So we chose Kodiak, because obviously you have to fly to Kodiak, it's not on the road system, Tok, on the road system, but pretty isolated. Same with Nanana. Unalaska, Mat-Su, primarily because it's the fastest growing area. Wrangell, because frankly the community has done an excellent job in Wrangell to begin to address the needs of individuals with behavioral health problems. So we tried to select a diverse array of communities. What we did is we have a contractor who goes into the community, conducts an initial community meeting, sets the expectation that we clearly want to move towards integrated services to better serve people with co-occurring disorders, and then explores with that community what's the best way to do it. What will come out of those meetings, and we are already seeing this, are community plans, plans that will talk about integration to better serve people, as well as to create some possible administrative efficiencies. One of the things that I would like to highlight, again to refer to Wrangell, is that the mental health organization and the substance abuse agency in Wrangell merged. They merged about a year ago. As a result, according to the director, they increased their service capacity by 200% as a result of administrative savings, which is frankly exactly what we were hoping to see. We created administrative efficiencies. Those dollars were redirected to direct service, and they're now able to serve more people. That is a significant change and improvement in our system.
Any other comments? Anybody on the
one question?
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have suggestions as to what we as a legislature can do to promote the work that you've started? Aside from the funding, I mean, is there legislation that you would like to see?
Representative Gardner, right now we are, when I first began thinking about the integration, I thought perhaps what we should do would be to start at the statutory level and go down. What I've learned over the last several months is it probably makes some sense to start at standards, determining what kinds of program standards, what kinds of programs do we need, what sort of competencies and credentials do the staff need, starting at the standards and then build up through regulations and then ultimately up to statute. So what I would like is, I guess I would anticipate coming before you next fiscal year with statutory change. And I'm hoping at that point we will have made additional progress and that the committee and the legislature would be supportive of that change.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the administrative efficiency level, I know in the departments we've combined human resource all into the Department of Administration, so the agencies are. Now, are most of the agencies that we're dealing with on these in the communities grant agencies so that they're not incorporated into that human resource model at the Department of Administration, or is there some way to accomplish that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the only service that our division supports directly is API. It's the only service we provide directly. We have still, I think this is too many, 300 grants going to about 135 grantees. And so the great majority of these are private not-for-profits. So the change, the human resource change within state government that you referred to really has not had an impact on our grantees.
And follow up, is there any coordination or any way that you can see that the state could work in partnership with the private nonprofits to avail them the administrative efficiency of Department of Administration's HR services, or is it just separate boxes that we keep everything in?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I guess most of my experience has been in as a provider in private not-for-profits, and as a private not-for-profit, the way I've viewed the world is we have both a social mission and a business mission. And the business mission is such that the organization needs to run efficiently, needs to make sure that dollars are being spent wisely. And at least in our division, we recognize that that's almost as important as the kinds of services that are provided. Because if we don't have a viable functional service system out there, we're not going to be able to provide the kinds of services that people need. As far as the link between human resources, I think there probably are some things that we've learned, that the Department of Administration has learned as a result of the centralizing the human resource function. I would have to explore probably within our division and with our department about how we might be able to take what we've learned and import it or target it to community providers, but something I certainly would be willing to look at.
Okay, thank you.
Bill, I know that the workforce for healthcare overall is just in the next few years, just in the next 8 years even, we're going to see a huge need, and we in Alaska we don't have the people to do it. And so I assume that with your university, that part of the presentation where you said the university is going to start opening classes, do you want to go into that a little bit more?
Madam Chair, I can. We are looking at a number of different endeavors, and perhaps it would be best to start at the top. And again, I think you make a good point, Madam Chair, that whatever we're doing now with the university, or probably as early as next fall, it's going to be several years before we see this impact. And this is a concern now. It's certainly a concern not only with our current array of providers, but as we develop residential psychiatric treatment centers, as an example. How can we staff these organizations? And many of the individuals we need in those organizations are entry-level people, in addition to master's-level clinicians and PhD psychologists. So I'll just go through this briefly. We are, in conjunction with the university, envisioning starting a PhD program in psychology I'm not sure if it's going to be at UAF, but I know we've been talking about UAF as being the primary focus. But this program is going to be for psychologists who are going to work in community settings. And I don't know how we can stipulate that other than we don't want to train psychologists to go off and work in private practice because that's not going to help our system. So we clearly want to develop the program to ensure that they're going to come and work in community settings where the need is. We're going to expand our master's degree program in social work. As many of you know, there's a distance program already. There's additional dollars in this proposal to expand that. The same with the Bachelor's of Social Work program. We plan to work with University of Alaska Southeast to begin to develop that workforce that I talked about to work in residential facilities, small residential facilities, as well as some of our larger facilities. We're looking at expanding the Rural Human Service Program, which I mentioned as well. And then we want to do at least some preliminary planning relating to a training academy for rural behavioral health. And so we have some money in there for that as well, where we envision actually, well, for instance, I think as people come into Alaska, they need to be oriented to what it's like to work in Alaska. I think they need some sort of at least a week's immersion in what that might be like, as an example. But really, our intent is to grow our own. We don't want to be in a position where we have to continue to import people from other states to do the work. We want to grow our own. We think we have really a really good potential. I think there's excellent people in Alaska. I think there's people that want to go into this line of career, this line of service. And I believe it's incumbent upon us to help them do that.
Are we going to have any type of to help with them? In other words, like, if they work in this community so long, that's kind of like a loan forgiveness program for going to school or something. I don't know how we'd fit that in, but is there any possibility of anything like that?
Madam Chair, we've talked about that. That is not part of this proposal. We've talked about stipends or scholarships or something similar to a public health service model where if somebody, if we help somebody go to school for X number of years, then they would, and if they served in an underserved area, then there would be some loan forgiveness. We've talked about all of that. But as I sit here, we're not ready to make a proposal at this point.
I can't imagine the numbers that we're talking about, but the numbers are phenomenal. I know by 2010, we're going to need 4,000 more nurses in this state. So that alone, so I can't imagine what the rest, the trickle-down effect to the other people that are helping them, And so it must be astounding when we really get down to the numbers and really find out. And so we definitely need the training, there's no doubt about that.
Madam Chair, we did undertake a project that was conducted by WICHE, the Western Interstate Consortium on Higher Education, who helped us look at the shortages. I would be glad to share that with the committee if you'd like to see that.
That would be great. Representative Sisler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I've been working on in Anchorage is with the school district in Anchorage. Now, the Matt Sue, I think there's probably some of the best work that's been done in the state in terms of trying to develop career ladders in the secondary schools and I think they even have an element in the elementary schools. But that's actually the direction we have to go, because if you can. By apparently the fourth grade, you've probably heard this, students have deselected, disselected the career that they will have in their life, and they are beginning then to focus on where they might go. And have you talked about or thought about ways to create incentives so that, and I know that in Southeast there's some good work being done in communities in the schools, but if we don't do it on the state level, create some kind of incentive. And it doesn't always have to be money that gets spent. It's just making sure that we have curricula that gets spread across the state, and it's being developed in some places in the state, but get it spread across the state so that students are beginning to look at health careers as really viable things that will keep them in their community and give them good, sustainable jobs.
Representative Sisna, through the chair, I think you make an excellent point. What I've talked about are people who have already selected or think that they might want to get into this field. But the reality is that we need to be doing things not only just in high schools, as you pointed out, but literally middle school and grade schools as well. Mm-hmm. Again, something we've talked about, I would like to hear perhaps what they've done in the MATSU as far as career ladders or encouraging individuals to go into careers. If you could share that with me, that would be helpful.
Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was engaged by your comment about trying to get people trained for the community service, but not to then go off into private practice or some other way. Are you envisioning sometimes a certification that would be acceptable to us within the department and within the state system that wouldn't be directly transportable to other areas so that we wouldn't be losing people? Or are you talking about, I mean, I'm not sure how you're accomplishing or you're attempting to accomplish the goal other than having a certificate that's not portable of training people that'll be in our community system but not go out into private practice and other segments of the career.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. Other than to stipulate as individuals enter the PhD program that we expect them to practice, and perhaps what we could do is to expect them to practice for X number of years in a certain area. We've talked a little bit about certification that would be exclusive to a community setting. We're not that far along in our thinking about this, but once we are further along, I'd be glad to share that with the committee. But I think you make a good point. How can we create some sort of an incentive, maybe a little bit short of mandate that somebody work in a community setting? Because I guess the other thing is what I don't want to get into is sort of a restraint of trade issue with where somebody can actually go if they're licensed. So I want to recognize that up front, but we really do need people in community settings. And psychologists have a lot to bring, a lot to offer, but many find their way into private practice. Frankly, the money is better in private practice, but there's some other reasons too, and we really need their input and their help with our most severely disabled individuals.
Representative McGuire.
Well, thank you. Two things, a question later, but on that point, I think the public health service model is a good one to look to. That's how my family came up here, and you know, there was a clear incentive to get your loans paid back, and you understood what you were getting into. And I don't see any other. I think you're probably going to have to go toward the incentive model, because the idea of restricting someone's license would be challenged. Clearly, I don't think it's legal. But I wanted to ask a little bit. I was just meeting with Nancy Burke earlier. On the subject of traumatic brain injury, it's a physical injury, but it leads to mental and cognitive disabilities, and so it falls in this mental health area. Have you thought about TBI services and how they fit into this new integrated health model?
Representative McGuire, through the chair, we received a grant from the Health Resources Services Administration for TBI. I think we're about 1.5 years into a 3-year grant. So the dollars have actually come into our division. We have been responsible for managing those dollars and helping to create the Traumatic Brain Injury or TBI Advisory Board. So we clearly recognize that individuals with traumatic brain injury have both mental health and substance abuse problems and need to be receiving services from our system. We also recognize, however, that it's not just a behavioral health problem. This is a physical problem, a disability, a developmental disability in some instances. And so we think that there needs to be greater focus beyond just our behavioral health system. What I don't think we need, however, is an entirely separate brand new system for traumatic brain injury. I think, you know, as we think about integrating services, I think we need to integrate services for that particular population as well. Mm-hmm. The challenge is how to fund it. And right now, if somebody with a traumatic brain injury has a mental health problem or mental health diagnosis, a serious mental health diagnosis, and they come into our system, that's how the service is paid for. I don't know if that's necessarily the case in some of the other systems. So there's a real challenge here, Representative McGuire, as I'm sure you can appreciate, about how we recognize there's a problem. One thing I did want to say to the committee, that effective July 1, 2004, and this is other data that I will produce, we have asked all of our grantees, frankly mandated that all of our grantees fill out what's called a screening, an Alaska screening instrument. So we are tracking all individuals in our system who have a mental health problem, a substance abuse problem, fetal alcohol syndrome, and traumatic brain injury. So we're going to be able to get much better numbers than we've ever been able to get about the extent of the problem. Now, having said that, once we identify people, the challenge is, what do we do? And I think we're just now at the beginning stages of trying to figure that out in conjunction with the TBI Advisory Board, with the Mental Health Trust, and others. I apologize, it's not a very definitive answer, but it's a problem that goes beyond just behavioral health, that we recognize that and commit to working with our stakeholders to see if we can come up with a solution.
I really appreciate your answer, and I know through the chair, and I know it's a really difficult problem to get our hands around. We just have such high rates of traumatic brain injury in the state. It reminds me of, you know, a decade ago when we didn't talk about fetal alcohol syndrome, and yet we knew that there were these pervasive problems in our system that led to behavioral health, that led to types of problems. And we finally put our fingers around it and started screening for it, tracking it, and learning how to treat fetal alcohol syndrome in a way that has led to a lot of productive lives. And I think we will find the same thing with TBI, that once you screen for it and identify that it's a TBI, not just the behavioral health side effect or component of it, or even the physical, but it's this whole concept. So, and I know dollars are the challenge, but I appreciate your answer.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your thorough presentation. Today I met with advocates from the Alaska Medical Association, and they were soliciting my sponsorship of legislation that would, I suppose, enhance the ability of foreign physicians, in your case, your purview, psychiatrists, to practice in Alaska. And they feel that there's such a shortage that this might curtail through recruitment efforts. Have you heard anything about that? And is there a shortage in terms of psychiatric treatment?
Representative Anderson, through the chair, there is a shortage of psychiatrists. There's a particular shortage of child psychiatrists. I know when I worked for the Mental Health Center in Wasilla, we recruited for a child psychiatrist for 3 years and never found one. So I do know that's a problem. I think the challenge, frankly, in having psychiatrists from other countries is that psychiatry or mental health counseling in general is conducted in a cultural context. And so it's difficult to have individuals new to the country or new to the state come in and really understand the nature of the problems based on culture. Mm. And so that would be the one caveat that I would have about bringing in a number of foreign-born doctors. On the other hand, I've had experience. I've been doing this a long time and have worked very well and worked with some very excellent foreign-born psychiatrists. So the short answer, Representative Anderson, is I do think there is a shortage, and I do think we need some additional psychiatrists in Alaska.
And through the chair, I'll check with you if I do sponsor that so we can work together. Thanks.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you. And actually, I have two things, if I may. One, sort of following up on Representative McGuire's comment about brain injury, you talk about integrated health services and sort of pulling together so that the dual diagnosis will get treatment. At the same time, what we know is that when you talk about a continuum of services, you're talking about this diverse state with all kinds of different problems, and there's all kinds of almost specialties in the kinds of services that people need. That drug treatment isn't the same as alcohol. That they're all sort of require different services. Could you answer what you're thinking in terms of making sure that we have the kind of diversity in services that we need while you're pulling this all together?
Representative Sisna, through the chair, the way I've envisioned this is that we do need a continuum. I've talked a little bit about this, from prevention through the most intensive services. And I do think we need some basic services available at the village level. We need some capability of recognizing a problem, doing some basic crisis intervention, providing some basic counseling skills at the village level. And then at the Anchorage level, we need, I would say, the broadest array and most intensive services, which would include some specialty services. On the other hand, I thought what you were going to ask, Representative Sisna, was the integration of behavioral health and primary care, which I think is our next big step, frankly.
Yeah.
That system definitely needs to be integrated because people have physical health problems and behavioral health problems, and I think this might be an opportunity or a place where we can address the TBI issue as well. So mm-hmm. I've tried to envision this as a continuum of care, again, from our smallest village to Anchorage, with Anchorage having the kinds of specialty services that kids and adults might need.
You know what? We've got two people online that would like to speak, so if we can at least go back to the two people online, and then thank you, Bill, very much, and I might have you come back, or you can just sit there, I guess. In Anchorage, in the LIO in Anchorage, we have two people. Kara Nyquist.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Go ahead and state your name and your affiliation.
For the record, this is Kara Nyquist. And I also have with me Pat Center, who's a registered nurse from Covenant House. And if I could, I'd like to allow Pat Center to go first because she has to leave here in 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Pat.
Well, I'm Pat Center, the family nurse practitioner at Covenant House, Alaska. And in that capacity, it's my responsibility for evaluating the roughly 500 youth a year that come through our crisis center residential program for both physical and mental health problems. I manage the medications the youth are on and assist the youth in obtaining physical and mental health care services that they might need. Because of my responsibilities, I am acutely aware of the mental health needs of our youth. And we're talking today in kind of in response to the Bring the Kids Home initiative. The single most important risk factor for the youth we serve to have difficulties in life is that their biological parents have issues. 80 to 90% of our youth have been either physically or sexually abused. Because of their parents' substance abuse problems, many of our youth have been prenatally exposed to either alcohol or drugs, and a large number of our youth suffer from milder forms of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Few of these youth with FASD have been formally diagnosed, and I can't tell you that enough. I give classes to the youth to try to discourage them from drinking during pregnancy, and when I go through it, there's this kind of look of horror on their face that, you know, what you're describing is actually me. Most of these youth at some time in their life have had interactions with the mental health system. A few of the youth we serve suffer from mild mental retardation, and a few have schizophrenia. The most common mental health issues our youth face are depression, ADHD, poor anger management, post-traumatic stress disorder, and sleep disorders. These are all common side effects of any kind of brain trauma, whether it be a stroke, traumatic brain injury, as we were discussing earlier, or in the case of our youth, a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I bring this up because I think there needs to be a paradigm shift in how we view the services we provide our youth. Many of these youth have a type of developmental disability that will be with them for their whole lives rather than having a mental illness that might be managed or cured. People with FASD have what is called poor executive functioning. They have extreme difficulties planning and connecting cause with effect. They live in the here and now and have difficulties planning for the future. They have very poor impulse control. Adolescence is a difficult time for any youth, but it is particularly difficult for youth who have been prenatally exposed to drugs and alcohol. Because these youth have poor judgment and impulse control, they frequently end up in some type of residential program, whether it be Covenant House, the criminal justice system, or residential mental health programs. Research done by the University of Washington found that of the youth with FASD they followed for 20 years, 80% have ended up in some type of supervised residential setting. I will admit that we have a rather biased perspective. We don't see the youth that are successful after being in a residential program. It seems to us at Covenant House that our current approach to handling these youth, including sending them to residential mental health facilities, is expensive and ineffective. We regularly get youth that have been recently discharged from a residential mental health facility out of state. They come to us with no long-term discharge plan, at most only a couple of weeks' worth of medications, and frequently their Medicare coverage has been allowed to lapse. It can take us months to obtain copies of their records from their placement facility, which makes it seem kind of ridiculous that we have spent, you know, often could be $100,000 in getting them evaluated, and no one down the line has any access to what the evaluation has actually shown. They frequently have been discharged from their local mental health provider here in the Anchorage area for failing to show up to appointments. And if you have a kid with poor impulse control, trying to get them to go to appointments is quite the task. We need to give thought to how we are going to provide care to these youth with a lifetime developmental disability. For the youth we see, their mental health issues can be easily handled on an outpatient basis. What is desperately needed is better strategies for dealing with their poor decision-making and impulsivity, which in many cases is caused by brain damage. We are seeing here today kind of the end result. They talked about the large number increase in kids in residential care. I think this reflects the increase in abuse of drugs and alcohol in our culture. There, a number of years back, was an emphasis of trying to get these kids out of their poor home environments and into what was considered a better care system of foster care. The foster parents and adoptive parents were often ill-prepared to take care of these special need kids. They had often had no idea what it was they were getting into. When these parents in desperation can no longer handle their children, they turn to residential programs as a way of trying to get them through the difficult adolescent period. We at Covenant House would certainly like to be part of, because of our practical experience with handling these types of kids, be involved in any kind of planning there is done for bringing these kids home. And we certainly hope that this will be a successful program.
Thank you, Pat. If you have that written out, could you fax it to us so that we have that?
Yes, I can.
Our fax is 465-3175. 465-3175. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Kara?
Okay, good afternoon again, everyone. Some of you might be aware I was present last Thursday down there in Juneau when Mr. Hogan presented, and I thank you for this opportunity to come back today telephonically to talk with all of you about some of my comments. I'm an attorney at Covenant House, but I not only represent Covenant House today, I also represent the Alaska Association of Homes for Children, which many of my colleagues were with me last week when we came to your committee meeting and had an opportunity to visit with you. For those of you that aren't familiar with the association, we've been meeting for about 18 years, and we all are nonprofit, community-based residential programs for homeless and runaway youth and provide a continuum of care, mental health, and substance abuse treatment for youth. For the last 3 years, we've been coming to Juneau for many years, but the last 3 years, the theme of our program and the reception that we've had actually has been bring the children home. And so we are in support of the administration's plan, and we're happy to see that they came up with this initiative, since it's something that has been of great concern for us for several years. I have some comments and then also some concerns. One, like I said, we do support the administration's plan. In the master plan, there's an emphasis on gatekeeping. We feel that gatekeeping is essential, given that many kids have been placed out of state by parents who were ill-equipped to meet with providers on what was the appropriate level of care for their youth. We're finding that many of the youth are in inappropriate levels of care outside of the state, and that they could have received treatment locally in a community-based program where they likely would have more success, especially when it comes to when they return home and the reunification efforts that are needed. Also wanted to emphasize the focus on the need to refocus dollars. You all looked at the chart last week that showed that the state spent approximately $40 million last year to serve just a few hundred kids in out-of-state care. To give you an example of how that $10 million would correlate, I added up the budget of all 18 programs in the Alaska Association of Homes for Children, and our budget collectively was approximately $40 million. And for that $40 million, we served over 10,000 kids. Many of the kids are the same kids that are going to these residential treatment providers outside of the state, and we know this because they're coming to our programs after they come home. Of that $40 million of the providers, a fourth of that money does come from the state through grants. The other $30 million is through fundraising, corporate donations, grants, federal money, and from national philanthropy groups that have given us money. Just want to focus on that there's a lot of good, experienced people in the state in these community-based programs that provide the continuum of care that's needed for many of these youth. But the unfortunate financial constraints faced over the years, that they could have had more beds for these kids if there could have been more grant dollars towards these programs in the future, hopefully, but if this could have been done years ago. I also want to emphasize, and the reason I brought Pat Center with me today, is that we feel that institutional care is not the answer for many of these youth. As there was talk last week, one of the programs, Cornell, is looking at the McKay Building downtown Anchorage right now to run a large institutional residential treatment for youth. Although we think some of these youth out of state are high-demand kids who need a high level of service, we do not think that there's a large need for more than one institution in the state. We feel that many of the community-based programs can serve these kids adequately and with great success. And that also, as Pat Center said, there needs to be a lifespan plan for these youth. We find that they're coming back from residential treatment and utilizing the community-based services because they're still in need of services. And we're seeing that if these kids don't receive a lifespan plan and aftercare, that these kids are landing up in the court system. And also, if we look at the fact that Alaska is ranked 50th in the nation for teen violent suicide deaths, it's really disheartening. And that's all my comments. Does anyone have any questions?
I don't see any hands raised, so I guess not. Thank you very much, both of you, for testifying, and it sure, hopefully, it gives us all, including the administration, some thoughts to take back with them. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions for Bill? Okay, if not, then I guess we'll have this. We'll adjourn the meeting, but next week we are having an overview. Actually, this week on Thursday, we'll have an overview on Children in Need of Aid by Marcy Kenai. And also Jan Rutherdale from the Department of Law, who is a district attorney. So we will learn more this coming week. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members.